The Supreme Court 2021-2022 season got underway on October 4th. Many well-known cases are on the docket.
The attack appears timed for maximum impact. As the injured lay on the pavement, blood staining the ground, emergency medical technicians, Boston police, and some 400 National Guardsmen already on hand for the race immediately triaged the wounded.
The FBI has collected huge amounts of information on innocent Americans simply because of their religion, and we want to ensure that that information is removed from the FBI's files.
We are here fighting gun violence. We need to turn the corner in 2021 by working with communities to really turn things around. And what do we have in the middle of that? The Supreme Court's going to consider making it easier for people to walk around with a gun? I mean, that's just backwards and dangerous.
A nonprofit is pressuring the city of Austin to appeal a recent ruling about the city's policy for digital billboards. In Austin, digital billboards are only allowed if they're on the premises of the company that put them up.
Multiple families who want to send their children to Christian schools in Bangor and Waterville sued the Department of Education back in 2018. It all stems from a DOE rule that allows families who live in towns that don't have a public school district to get money to send their kids to a public or private school of their choice. However, religious schools are excluded from that funding.
And convicted killer John Henry Ramirez says that he is being denied the right to have his spiritual advisor with him when his sentence is carried out.
Yeah, Ramirez is set to be executed on September 8th for a murder that stunned the city.
The state of Mississippi came to the Supreme Court and asked the justices to weigh in. But in their brief on the merits, they've asked the Supreme Court to look at whether or not to overrule Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
Each of those headline news stories spun lawsuits that have now reached the U.S. Supreme Court. The nine justices will wrestle with questions about capital punishment, school funding, abortion, and other controversies that are sure to affect the lives of Americans for generations to come.
I, Clarence Thomas.
I, Sonia Sotomayor.
I, Neil M. Gorsuch.
I, Elena Kagan.
I, Samuel A. Alito, Jr.
I, Stephen Breyer.
I, Amy Coney Barrett.
I, Brett M. Kavanaugh, do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will administer justice
without respect,
to persons.
That I will support and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge
the duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
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 Welcome to Legal Docket. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Jenny Ruff. This podcast is from the team that brings you the world and everything in it.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Come with us inside the world of the Supreme Court as we look more deeply into current disputes and how they make a difference to your life.
All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States.
Today, a preview of the new Supreme Court term that began the first Monday in October.
God save the United States and this honorable court.
Support for the Legal Docket podcast comes from listeners like you. Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a biblical solution to healthcare, connecting Christians across the nation who care for one another spiritually and financially when a medical need arises. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.
Well, Jenny, here we are at the start of a brand new term of the Supreme Court.
That's right. And so we thought it a good time to preview some of the big cases already on the court's calendar. And just to clarify, season two of the Legal Docket podcast isn't over quite yet. God willing, we'll focus on one more case next week.
Well, that's right. And we've picked a handful of cases to preview that we think you'll find interesting. And it's important to note that the court's argument calendar is not yet filled up. Typically, the court hears somewhere between 60 and 80 cases per term. So definitely there are some biggies out there that we just don't know about yet.
We'll be covering each of those every Monday on our sister podcast, The World and Everything in It. So we won't miss anything.
Every single case. All right, let's get to it.
All right. Well, we'll start with a case scheduled for argument December 1st. Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. It centers on a law about abortion. This case is huge, even more important than the last two major abortion rulings. Those earlier cases dealt with a more narrow aspect of the debate. That is, what it means to unduly burden a woman who wants to get an abortion.
This case focuses more on the unborn child. It asks whether it's unconstitutional for Mississippi to ban nearly all abortions after 15 weeks gestation. Now, a little context around abortion jurisprudence might help. Current Supreme Court doctrine combines two prior decisions, Roe v. Wade and Casey v. Planned Parenthood. Taken together, those rulings say that when the unborn child is not yet viable, a state cannot impose an undue burden on a woman's right to an abortion.
But technology is changing the viability factor. Around 23, 24 weeks, a child, despite prematurity, can survive outside the womb. And what undue burden really means hasn't been clarified in all circumstances. So that standard is what the justices will revisit. Here are the facts of the Mississippi case. In 2018, the state passed the Gestational Age Act that prohibits abortions after 15 weeks, with a couple of exceptions. Right now, Mississippi has one licensed abortion facility, and it sued, along with one of its doctors.
Yeah, and they said that this directly defies Roe v. Wade. The abortionist won in lower court, and now the Supreme Court will hear the case. Barry McDonald is a constitutional law professor at Pepperdine University. He's written a lot about abortion law. McDonald clarifies the precise question for the justices. And when he says plaintiffs, he means the abortion facility and the doctor challenging the law.
The interesting thing is, out of all the claims that the plaintiffs made about, this law being unconstitutional, the Supreme Court just basically issued an order and said, okay, the only question that we're interested in addressing in this case is whether all pre-viability bans on abortion are unconstitutional.
In other words, the Supreme Court is open to reevaluating viability as the essential point that determines when a state can ban abortions. What does that mean for Roe?
I think essentially we are open to either revising the Roe-Casey framework substantially or at least sort of agreeing that a state can move the key marker earlier in the pregnancy to when a state can ban abortions.
Does that mean overturning Roe? Maybe, but McDonald foresees the court tinkering instead.
I think the easiest path for the court would be not to overrule Roe, to sort of retain its holding that there is a right of a woman to get an abortion before a certain point. I just think that you might get a coalition of justices to say that, well, that point is earlier than when the fetus becomes viable. It's really roughly around what Mississippi has determined is a legitimate milestone for that, which is the 15-week mark. That would allow them to say we're not overruling Roe versus Wade or Casey. We're just sort of modifying those rulings a bit.
Please accept my apologies. Wonder what would have been. Tomboy running around, hanging with all the guys. Or a little tough boy with beautiful brown eyes. I pay for the murder before they determine the sex. Choosing our life over your life meant your death.
So that's the big pro-life case this term. Well, let's move on now to another dispute the Supreme Court will hear.
It's more than a marathon. It's the marathon.
This case arises from April 2013, when two brothers detonated bombs at the Boston Marathon, intent on jihad against Americans. Three people lost their lives that day, including 8-year-old Martin Richard. Hundreds of others suffered grievous, life-altering injuries, including Richard's little sister, who lost both of her legs in the blasts.
The older brother was killed in a shootout with police. 2 years later, 19-year-old Dzhokhar Tsarnaev received the death penalty for his part in the bombings. He appealed, alleging the jury selection process violated his constitutional rights to due process and an impartial jury, among other things. The trial court hadn't asked potential jurors about what media coverage they'd seen about the case, nor had evidence been allowed in about the older brother's prior crimes. that might have shown undue influence over the younger brother and mitigated some of his actions.
Well, the appeals court agreed with him and threw out the death sentences. So now the United States appeals, asking the justices to find that the appeals court got it wrong. Now, it's important to note that Tsarnaev is serving several life sentences, so even if he prevails here, he won't be released from prison.
Moving along now to our next case.
If any decision is going to have a real impact on Americans' day-to-day life, and I mean their day-to-day life, it's going to be this decision.
That's Pepperdine Law Professor McDonald again, talking about New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, a dispute over gun laws. He gives a super brief history of when the Second Amendment in the Bill of Rights became an individual right. That happened in a 2008 case. Before then,
the Supreme Court had never held that the Second Amendment guaranteed a right to own weapons for purposes of self-defense. If you look at the Second Amendment, you got to focus on the prefatory clause, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
That comma, McDonald pointed out, that's caused a lot of debate about the purpose of the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court in 2008 held that the Second Amendment guaranteed an individual's right to own weapons for the purpose of self-defense in the home. And they called it a fundamental right. The upcoming case goes a step further, outside the home.
Correct. That's the question here, whether that right extends outside the home. Two men and a gun rights advocacy organization sued over a state law.
You have two plaintiffs that wanted to be able to get a license, as New York requires, to carry concealed weapons in public. But New York law requires that there be a special self-defense need in order to get such a license. And one of the plaintiffs basically just cited the fact that he lives in a neighborhood that has experienced a string of robberies. And the other plaintiff just said, well, I'm just well-trained in firearm use, and I shouldn't need a special justification to carry a concealed weapon in public. And so they're just suing to say that this requirement of a special needs in order to get a license to carry a concealed weapon in public violates their Second Amendment rights.
In other words, New York law says you have to have good cause to conceal carry outside the home.
Other states have similar restrictions on guns. For example, Massachusetts and California. But constitutional rights labeled as fundamental are usually subject to strict scrutiny. That's the highest level of judicial review. It requires that the government show a compelling interest before infringing on certain rights. And even the compelling interest must be narrowly tailored to achieve that interest. That is not the test the lower courts applied after the High Court's 2008 ruling.
Instead, the lower courts have adopted a form of intermediate scrutiny. They have looked at certain gun restrictions carefully for a number of reasons, like concern over mass shootings.
The Supreme Court has declined to hear appeals from these lower court rulings until now. Will they signal to the lower courts to start applying strict scrutiny? Will the court extend the Second Amendment to include the right to bear arms outside the home?
McDonald says what the court will do is always a big question mark. But in this case, he thinks it will side with the gun law.
I think that the prospect of, you know, essentially seeing courts strike down these sorts of special needs requirements and having millions of Americans out there having guns tucked under their coats, walking around in public, I think that that's going to make them extremely nervous, especially in this day of, you know, daily shootings.
I might have hung up my shotgun, but I didn't put it up so high that I can't reach up and get it back down if you give me a reason why. But I hung up my shotgun.
Well, on now to our fourth case to preview. This one asks whether a woman who was denied a sign language interpreter can sue for damages for emotional distress. Jane Cummings was born deaf. She went to a rehab clinic to treat her back pain and asked that the clinic provide an interpreter to communicate with her in American Sign Language. The clinic declined to do that, but offered to communicate with written notes or lip reading, or Cummings could bring in her own interpreter.
That prompted Cummings to sue the clinic, alleging discrimination based on her disability. She sued under several laws: the Americans with Disabilities Act, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the Affordable Care Act, to name three. The lower courts found she couldn't be compensated for humiliation, frustration, and emotional distress under the laws she relied upon.
So now the Supreme Court must decide whether she can be compensated for emotional distress under these laws. All right, now on to our fifth case to touch on today. This one arises out of Maine. I spoke to the lawyer for one side. Now, remember, this is a preview, not a complete treatment. Michael Bendis with the Institute for Justice. I'll let him explain.
Maine has a town tuitioning program. Basically, if you live in a town in Maine that doesn't either operate its own public school or contract with a school to educate the kids from that town, the town has to pay tuition for those students to attend the school of their choice, be it public or private. But the one type of school Maine does not allow is any school the state deems to be sectarian, basically meaning any school that provides any kind of religious instruction.
Two families sued when the state denied them tuition money for the school of their choice, which happened to be religious schools. The school doesn't even have to be in this country. Maine routinely pays for children to attend schools in other districts and even abroad.
But a student better not dare try to go to a Jewish day school or their local Catholic parish's school, because that's off limits. Maine claims that it wants to ensure that the children who participate in the tuitioning program receive an adequate substitute for a public school education. The problem with that argument, though, is the religious schools that want to participate provide all of the secular instruction that the state requires under the state's compulsory education law. The state has already determined that these schools are an adequate substitute for a public education, and yet the state continues to exclude them.
This dispute might sound familiar to you. Not long ago, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Espinoza v. Montana Department of Revenue. That decision said it's unconstitutional for a state to permit funding for education in general while prohibiting it for religious schools. So, what gives?
The state did some clever tactics to try to navigate its way around that decision and really kind of force this issue to the point where the Supreme Court has to step in again. What the court said in Espinoza is that you can't exclude a school from a program like this just because it is religious, just because it has a religious status. Well, Maine argued, and the First Circuit in its decision in the Carson case said, well, Maine's not really excluding schools because they are religious. It's excluding schools because of the religious use to which a student's tuition benefit would be put, namely providing religious instruction. And somehow this was a distinction with a constitutional difference in the First Circuit's mind.
So that's about school funding, the religion clauses, and the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. All right, next case, Fazaga versus FBI, a surveillance matter. Drones, security cameras, GPS trackers, Ring, Alexa. It's unnerving to think how easily we're spied on.
Government surveillance on American citizens and lawful residents.
The Fazaga case is just a crazy one.
That's Steve Schwinn, constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago, co-editor of the Constitutional Law Prof blog. He tells the story.
What happened in this case is a number of Muslim individuals in Southern California alleged that they were subject to electronic surveillance in violation of what's called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
The FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA for short. Yasser Fazaga and others sued the FBI. They alleged the FBI targeted them specifically because of their religious beliefs.
And in doing so, violated their First Amendment right of religious freedom. But the FBI argues the FISA allows it to conduct the undercover monitoring here.
The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act allows the government in certain circumstances to go to a special court called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or FISC, F-I-S-C, to get a secret warrant to engage in electronic surveillance in the national security.
But the plaintiffs objected and sued.
So the FBI has to mount a defense. But the FBI says, hang on, if we provide information to defend ourselves, that could threaten national security. So we're invoking a privilege, the state secrets privilege.
The government says, if we are to reveal information that is necessary in this case in order to defend the FBI and our officers against claims of religious freedom, the information could threaten the national security. And so therefore, we can't reveal that information.
And when the FBI invokes this privilege, it goes through a formal process. The attorney general, or someone in the know, signs an affidavit, a sworn statement under oath. That person vouches for the fact that the information could indeed threaten national security.
At that point, the judge takes a look at the affidavit, but not necessarily the actual evidence. Looks at the affidavit and makes a determination, do I have faith in this affidavit, and therefore I'll exclude the evidence, or do I not trust the affidavit, and therefore I'll allow the evidence to come into the case?
And the district court allowed the FBI to do just that, to invoke the state secrets privilege. And in turn, it dismissed the religious liberty claim. But on appeal, the court said, wait, we don't think the state secrets privilege is applicable here.
Instead, what's applicable in this case is a particular provision in the FISA that allows a court to examine evidence in camera and ex parte, that is away from the parties, outside of the presence of the parties, and in camera in the judge's chambers by the judge's self.
So the judge would examine the actual evidence, and the judge would decide if what the FBI claims is actually true, that the evidence it would use to defend itself really would threaten national security.
This appeal to the Supreme Court followed. The FBI argues the state secrets privilege does apply. And no second guessing allowed. It argues the privilege is rooted in the president's constitutional authority to protect national security and engage in foreign affairs. So courts must grant the FBI extraordinary deference when it's invoked.
In other words, it's a trump card. The court must dismiss the case. Shut it down.
It sounds highly technical, and somebody might be scratching their head and ask, well, who cares, right? This actually matters quite a bit. The state secrets privilege is a privilege that we saw the government exert with actually kind of breathtaking aggressiveness in the so-called war on terror.
And none of those previous cases got to the Supreme Court. So here, the Supreme Court has a chance to address things like what evidence can go forward, and how can courts consider that evidence? Schwinn points out there's always other ways for the court to resolve a case, but it is a chance for the Supreme Court to determine the scope and extent of the state secrets privilege, a big important one or a lesser important one.
And so really, on some level, the question is, to what degree are the courts going to defer to that affidavit and that say-so? You know, we've seen in our country's history where the courts have deferred to the government's say-so when the government claims that particular evidence would raise a national security concern. And it turned out later to be revealed that it wasn't a national security concern at all. It was just trying to cover up embarrassment. Depending on how broadly the Supreme Court defines the state secrets privilege, it could set up a system of incentives for exactly that kind of thing to happen.
Intriguing. Well, we'll certainly keep our eye on that one.
Oh, beautiful. What special sky.
Spacious skies, purple mountains, majesties,
and lots of billboards. Beautiful America. File this next case under First Amendment, free speech, billboard speech. City of Austin, Texas v. Reagan National Advertising of Texas. Here's University of Chicago law professor Steve Schwinn again.
The city of Austin has a ban on what they call off-premises advertising signs. And here we can think of billboards that are not at the site of a business, right? A billboard that advertises for a business that's off-site of the business, which is a typical billboard that I think most of us are familiar with.
So the city bans those, but it grandfathered in billboards that existed before the ban took effect, older billboards.
A regular old sort of static billboard that is, you know, either painted on or plastered on.
Well, those billboard operators wanted to change their old school billboards to flashy electronic advertisements. The city of Austin said no. You can change the message, but not the technology. The billboard operators sued and argued that that violates their First Amendment free speech rights.
What's known as a content-based restriction on free speech. The Supreme Court has taken the position that regulations should be treated with suspicion if they regulate expressive activities. The billboard operators say that's what the city is doing here. It's a clever argument. Listen closely.
The government here is restricting the kind of speech of the billboard operators based on the content of their speech. Now, this isn't obvious. What they're saying is that you have to actually read the content of the billboard to determine whether the billboard is on-site or off-site. And because you have to read the content of the billboard in order to make that determination, the rule itself is content-based.
In other words, the billboard operators say the signage code prohibits certain off-premises signs. The only way to know if a sign is off-premises, if goods are offered in a different location, is to read the sign. Because you have to read the content of the sign to understand that, the city's trying to regulate content-based speech. And that's not allowed under the First Amendment.
The city of Austin is saying, no, 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 this isn't about what the billboard says. This is just a law about a content-neutral time, place, and manner restriction on speech. They're concerned with aesthetics and don't want flashing ads that could distract drivers. So that's the fight in that case.
I get slandered.
All right, now we turn from signage to something much more somber. This is our final case that we will preview for today. I think the late evangelist Billy Graham's words underscore the seriousness of it.
I think we're all conscious that this life is very temporary and it's very short. The older you get, the shorter it seems. We're all facing death, and we all better get worried about it and be sure we're right with God.
It's a case that may finally settle a problem that's cropped up in the most somber of places, the death chamber.
We're going to get straight to it. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a stay of execution for John Henry Ramirez. He's convicted of killing Corpus Christi convenience store clerk Pablo Castro in 2004.
That stay of execution came in the 11th hour in September. Death row inmate John Ramirez wants his Southern Baptist pastor to pray out loud and lay hands on him while he is executed. Ramirez says that to deny him that violates the First Amendment and the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act.
But the prison has a policy about this. For one thing, a background check on the spiritual advisor's credentials must be done. That takes time. The spiritual advisor needs to complete a two-hour in-person orientation with a staff member. Other rules apply too, and all have time requirements in which to request and then complete them. The inmate didn't meet those requirements, and he kept changing what kind of spiritual help he wanted.
Listen to Elaine Salcedo. She's the sister-in-law of the murder victim after hearing the news that Ramirez's execution is delayed for the third time.
From here on out, it's just a waiting game. It's just a waiting game, and once again, the family's put on trial because they have to go through this.
Ramirez's attorney, Seth Kratzer, sympathized with how disappointed the family of Pablo Castro must be with another delay. Kratzer acknowledges his client will eventually die by lethal injection, But
there is no prayer-free zone in our country. There is no godless vacuum in the execution chamber or anyplace else. If laws are laws that the Constitution applies, has to apply everywhere and always, every corner of our fair land, and that even includes the hell of an execution chamber right before a citizen is put to death.
Texas argues it isn't forcing Ramirez to do something that violates his faith. It's merely declining to accommodate all that he requests. And that, it argues, does not substantially burden his rights.
Well, that concludes our preview of some cases to be argued during this next Supreme Court term. And as we noted earlier, the justices will add many more cases to fill out the entire term. Next week is our final installment for Season 2 of Legal Docket Podcast. Think Thomas Edison, the Wright brothers, Alexander Graham Bell. We're going to cover a case about inventors.
Legal Docket is produced by the creative team at World Radio. I'm Jenny Ruff.
And I'm Mary Reichard. We're the hosts each week, and we research and write the scripts. Our script editor is Paul Butler, who is also our producer. Technical engineer is Rich Rosel.
We want to thank our guests who gave us insight into these cases: Barry McDonald, Michael Bindis, and Steve Schwinn. Music from Flipside, the Randy Rogers Band, Ray Charles, and Simon & Garfunkel. Other audio sources include ABC News, Al Jazeera, the Associated Press, the Boston Athletic Association, WCSH, EWTN, and KRIS-TV.
Thank you for leaving us ratings and reviews. And if you've also shared this podcast with others, all the better. It's fuel to propel us to a season 3 next summer, God willing.
On behalf of our entire team, we thank you for listening.
Support for the Legal Docket Podcast comes from listeners like you. Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a community of Christians who, through prayer, encouragement, and financial support, will care for you when you have a medical need. When the body of Christ comes together to provide for one another, burdens are lifted and God is glorified. This applies to all areas of life, including healthcare. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/worldpodcast.